Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well. Coming up, we'll take a look at COVID-19, the very latest on the vaccine front, as well as the reopening of outdoor dining at restaurants here in Southern California. But we begin with the very latest on politics, where each day brings a new series of events for us to focus on and to keep updated on. This morning, one of the things that we're going to take a little time to do is to try and explain how the Senate is operating right now. As you know, it's got a 50-50 split between the parties, which requires them to come up with rules of operation, how the committee assignments are going to be made, how the committees are chaired, and has to do with a number of other power-sharing issues. That, of course, even though Democrats, on a practical level, are able to break a 50-50 tie on any legislation through Vice President Kamala Harris being a Democrat. But you've also got efforts to move legislation without 60 votes. That could mean ending the filibuster, which effectively requires a 60-vote threshold for legislation. Or one could use the reconciliation process to get bills through that have financial, budgetary implications. We'll talk more about that as well. But let's begin with the very latest. What's going on in Capitol Hill and in the White House? Covering Congress and U.S. politics for the Wall Street Journal, reporter Andy Duren joins us. Andy, thank you for being with us today. Let's start off with what we have from President Biden today, including a series of orders that he's signing dealing with racial equity and support for underserved communities.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. So it's another we're almost a week into the Biden presidency, and he is continuing to roll out a number of executive orders. He's done so, I think, just about every day in his short tenure so far. And today, yeah, there are several focused on racial equity, including one that will phase out the federal use of private prisons. And on top of that, there are discussions ongoing between the administration and folks on Capitol Hill looking at another coronavirus COVID-19 relief bill. So President Biden has a $1.9 trillion plan that he would like to see Congress pass in the near future. And so discussions have been ongoing about that between both Democrats and Republicans and the new administration. And there are more talks scheduled for today among some members of the House and administration officials.
Andy, we're just getting word of a major internet outage extending from D.C. up to Boston, affecting internet and cloud providers, as well as a number of Google services and Facebook. Have you experienced that? I assume you're in D.C. Have you experienced that there?
I am in Washington, and thankfully I have not yet. I've only seen some of those reports, but otherwise I don't know. I don't know much about it.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious if it's something you'd had any problems with so far. Let's talk about the power sharing issue first of all. With the 50-50 party split, what is the deal that's been cut between McConnell and Schumer to enable the committees to be established?
So a several-day-long standoff between Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell ended yesterday when Mitch McConnell agreed to go forward with a power-sharing agreement that will resemble the power-sharing agreement that was in place the last time the Senate was evenly divided between the two parties in 2001. And so that will allow committees to start to form and for Democrats to begin to take control of the chairmanships and the, you know, majority staff resources that committees have access to, or the majority party and committees have access to. And the holdup had been Republican leader McConnell's demand that the organizing resolution for this evenly divided Senate include an explicit avowal from Democrats that they would not move to eliminate the filibuster. So in the Senate, 60 votes are required to end debate on a bill. And in recent years, increasingly parties have, you know, needed to have those 60 votes, or bills have needed to have those 60 votes to be able to move forward in the chamber, effectively requiring, you know, creating a 60 vote threshold for most legislation in the Senate. And so there has been some activism and some demand among Democrats in recent years to eliminate that requirement and move the chamber towards a more majoritarian model where, you know, just a simple majority, 51 votes would be sufficient to pass legislation. Leader Schumer, the new majority leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, had refused to commit to never getting rid of the filibuster or not getting rid of the filibuster during this Congress. But Mitch McConnell relented on his position when two Democrats who had previously said they were opposed to eliminating the filibuster said again publicly that they would not support eliminating the filibuster. And so Mitch McConnell lifted what was effectively his filibuster of the organizing resolution, and now they're the Senate is on track to having a formal power sharing agreement that will set some of the rules for how a Senate with an even split between the parties operates.
So one thing I'm a little unclear on is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema. As you say, it both, you know, been on record that they were not in favor of doing away with the filibuster. So I understand that they reinforced that position, but there's nothing in writing. There's no guarantee. There's all you have is the continuation of the position that those two senators have had, which effectively blocks Democrats from doing away with the filibuster. So what led Mitch McConnell then to change his mind? It doesn't sound like anything really changed, and he has no guarantee.
I think it was the, Republicans point to the more, forceful and explicit commitments from Senators Manchin and Sinema. But at the same time, I think Democrats and certainly Chuck Schumer would say, would certainly point out that there has been no change necessarily in the status quo, and that, you know, there's nothing binding Democrats from not necessarily taking this step in the future. I mean, obviously, those public comments are those public comments from Senators Manchin and Sinema, but certainly, you know, the tides can change, and, you know, an appetite to take procedural steps that might not exist now can develop. And so it will certainly still be something to watch, whether Democrats, you know, this conversation about the filibuster, how it develops and how it continues over the next 2 years. But for now, it seems that it's not a step that the party is going to be taking in the near future.
We're talking with Andy Durand, who's reporter covering Congress and U.S. politics for The Wall Street Journal. Also with us from the University of Southern California, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy, Christian Gross, who's also the Academic Director of the USC Schwarzenegger Institute for State and Global Policy. Professor Gross, so good to have you with us. We're talking, of course, about the 50-50 party split in the Senate, but with Democrats having the additional leverage of the vice president being a Democrat. As you look at this whole process, has it been fairly consistent historically how the two parties have shared their power at 50-50?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. This is not without precedent to have 50 senators from one party and 50 from the other, or a split Senate in days in which we didn't have 50 states. You know, the most recent time was in 2001, when there were 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, and the vice president at the time was Dick Cheney, who was the tie-breaking vote in the case of a party-line vote. And so that also had a power-sharing agreement, but the power-sharing was directed mostly by the Republican Party with their having one vote. And then, of course, during that year, Senator Jim Jeffords, who was a Republican, switched parties to become an independent, the caucus with the Democrats, shifting control to the Democrats. So the most recent precedent, there was a power sharing agreement. If you go back to the 1950s, an area that I've studied a lot, there was a Senate in 1953 and 54 that also had a split Senate because some Republicans had died. Republicans started the Congress in control. They died and were replaced by Democrats. And it led to a 50-50 split with the Republican vice president being the tie-breaking vote. And then that also was under a power-sharing agreement, even to the point where one of the Republicans died, giving Minority Leader Lyndon Johnson the control of the chamber in terms of the total number of votes. But they continued under a power-sharing arrangement for a month until a senator was seated to replace the person that died. So if we look back over the last, 70 years, we've had two other instances like this, super split Senates. A lot of power in both the majority and the minority party in those instances, because of the filibuster, but also just the 50-50 split. But the vice president, the party in charge of the vice president, is really important for basically the tiebreaker in terms of the organization of the Senate.
And in those previous cases, have there ever been pieces of legislation that actually came down to strict party line vote where the leverage of the vice president's vote was the decider?
Oh yeah, there have been votes where vice presidents have been the deciding vote. Al Gore cast an important deciding vote early on in the Bill Clinton presidency, even though that wasn't a 50-50 Senate. But there are definitely cases like that. And if you go back to the 1950s, not only was the vice president essential, but it was actually the fact the vice president is there to cast a tie-breaking vote keeps certain things off the agenda. So things that would have otherwise passed under, say, a Republican control of one vote or two votes, didn't pass because the threat of the vice president being there was enough to keep it from coming.
And that's probably even more common than it ever actually getting to the floor for a vote.
I think that's the most likely. So we rarely see the vice president casting tie-breaking votes. I think we will see some. I think Kamala Harris is going to be a tiebreaker in some instances here. But more likely, it's just having Kamala Harris as VP in a 50-50 Senate gives the Democrats a lot more power to keep things off the floor than they would otherwise with a 51-49 Republican.
We're talking with Christian Gross, associate professor at the University of Southern California, and the Wall Street Journal reporter covering Congress and U.S. politics, Andy Duren. If you have questions about some of the terminology and the procedures in which the U.S. Senate is now engaged, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Also, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can tweet at AirTalk, or you can post on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org with any of your questions. Let's talk a little bit more about the filibuster itself, Professor Gross. And why, given the fact that even if things have become increasingly partisan and divided, why has the Senate held on to what is that effective 60-vote threshold? How does it benefit some of its members, not just those in the minority?
Yeah, the filibuster has been an important part of the Senate to protect minority rights, and minority meaning the numerical minority in the Senate. But even senators like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who you were talking about earlier, the reason they might like the filibuster is it keeps them off the hot seat on really difficult bills, right? If there's a vote that is unlikely to get 60 senators, meaning there aren't 10 Republicans to support it, Manchin and Sinema, in the case of Manchin, especially in a very Republican state, can avoid taking positions that would be problematic for his electorate. So there's some of the moderate Democrats, even in the majority, might prefer to hold on to the filibuster just so they can avoid these very narrow 51 to 50 votes that could occur. And the other thing is sometimes the filibuster, the filibuster does block things and delay things, and it makes it really hard to pass things. That's really a problem in our polarized environment. But some Democrats who are institutionalists and some Republicans who are institutionalists would prefer to keep it because they remember what it was like to be in the minority, right? The filibuster did not exist for Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination, for instance. So if you like Amy Coney Barrett, you might not like having a filibuster if Republicans are in charge. If Democrats are in charge, there will be different outcomes. But those who've been around for many years remember what it's like to be in the minority and hold on to that for the future when they'll probably be in the minority again.
I'd kind of assumed, you know, once Harry Reid led the end of the filibuster for federal judges, and then that was ended for Supreme Court justice nominations, that the next, you know, sort of the third step in that process would be the filibuster overall being voted out. But Professor, what you're saying, it sounds like as long as there's some purple in the country, that's going to be tough to see that happen.
I think it's going to be tough. I don't think it's out of the question. I think you're exactly right. The changes to the federal nominations and then Supreme Court nominations have led the way for possible broader changes to ending the filibuster. I mean, the 60-vote rule to end a filibuster has not always been that way. It used to be a two-thirds majority instead of a 60% majority, and that was changed because in the 1970s, because senators weren't able to get anything done, so they reduced the number of votes to end a filibuster. You can maybe imagine that being a change instead of an outright elimination of the filibuster. And then the other thing, just from the Democratic perspective, I know a lot of Democrats right now would really like to end the filibuster so that they could get more things passed. But the Senate is still a minority-oriented institution. A bunch of states elect senators that are then the states are really small and don't represent the country as a whole. Most of the votes in the Senate, even when the Republicans controlled it and McConnell was the leader.
I think we just lost our guest. His phone just cut out. Good chance for us to take a break. We'll continue our conversation. That's USC Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy, Christian Gross, and Andy Duren, joining us from the Wall Street Journal, where he's congressional and U.S. politics reporter. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about the transition into this new U.S. Senate, what sort of power-sharing agreements are going on, also talking about the future of the filibuster, and we'll talk about what's known as the reconciliation process, which can be kind of confusing because it's got some gray areas. We'll dive into those when we continue on Air Talk in 1 minute. I mentioned at the top of the program today that President Biden has signed a series of four different orders dealing with racial equity and support for underserved communities. One of them would end the Department of Justice's use of private prisons. So that would be federal private prisons, of course. It recommits the federal government to respect tribal sovereignty and strengthens the nation-to-nation relationship between the U.S. and tribal nations. At least that's how that order is billed. Also, there are actions designed to provide protections to Asian American and Pacific Islander communities against racism and attacks based on race and ethnicity. Also directing HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, to address racially discriminatory federal housing policies that have contributed to wealth inequality. Also today, the Senate confirmed Antony Blinken as the Secretary of State on a 78-22 vote. This after Republicans were apparently appeased when he said he would continue the harder line toward China that had risen during the Trump years, the years of that administration. Again, if you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk about the reconciliation process, Professor Gross. What is that?
Yeah, sure. The reconciliation process is basically the one time that you don't need the 60 votes in the Senate to end a filibuster. So it's basically used for budgets and anything that's budget related. Traditionally, it's used once a year, but there have been some really savvy maneuvers to fold what is basically legislation into the budget process in order to allow it to be passed by 51 votes. So, you know, one of the most recent ones that was really well known was the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was passed via budget reconciliation. So it did not require It did not require that 60-vote threshold in the Senate. There's some other issues with doing that. You can't have differences between the House and the Senate. The bills have to pass. It does have to be for budget-oriented things, but most policy at the end of the day does have a budget component.
Okay. And one of the questions that's been raised is, can you use this reconciliation process, simple majority for a budget-related item, for something like increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which President Biden has proposed, raising the federal minimum to that level? Is that something that is part of the budget process?
Yeah, I mean, my take on it would be that, yes, you could do that. And so it's really up to Chuck Schumer and the Democratic senators, right? So if they want to consider that as part of the budget, in the budget process, and they would have to work with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to do the same thing, they could pass that through reconciliation. Anything that involves spending could arguably be part of budget reconciliation. The only things that really might be outside of that would be anything that didn't involve taxes, spending, and so on. And also the other issue is it can't be used, or as it has been practiced, it cannot be used frequently, right? So it's traditionally only once a year, and could be used up to three times a year for taxes and spending bills. But yeah, I think something like minimum wage and other budgetary related issues could be folded into a reconciliation package.
So if you could use it up to three times a year, are those written rules, by the way?
So just hardly any of the rules are written in the Senate because the Senate has so few rules. But what has been done previously is most of the time since the 1970s, there's been one budget per year, right? And so that's the budget reconciliation has been done once. But you could technically have budget reconciliation separately on tax-related bills and then on spending-related, too. So you could do revenue separately from the spending side. And then there could be an emergency reconciliation package as well, which could be related to the debt limit, too. So there's some flexibility if they want to get creative. It would be probably changing things a little bit in terms of how they've done it in practice.
Okay. Because it sounds like then almost anything could be passed in a straight vote. And if you have up to three times a year to use it, you could put a lot of things into each of the reconciliation bills, couldn't you?
Exactly. I mean, there could be objections, and this would be you'd have to have all the Democrats in the Senate on board with doing so, right? And if they weren't willing to do that, then there would probably be a problem. But you'd have to get the 51 votes in the Senate and then a majority of the House willing to do this and willing to pass the bill through a reconciliation process.
Andy Duren of the Wall Street Journal, what's your sense of the appetite of Democrats to take most of the provisions of the president's COVID-19 relief package and to pass them through reconciliation?
Well, I think that's very much an open question at this point. There's both a debate among Democrats about whether to do reconciliation at all in terms of, both the practical process of the time it takes to pass a bill via reconciliation, and then whether that is kind of the first step forward that Democrats want to take when they have control of the government, given President Biden's, call for unity and bipartisanship. If, the first major legislative effort they want to undertake is something that's, the most purely partisan procedural process that they can pursue. So there's that question. And then kind of beyond that, there's a question, there's a separate discussion among Democrats about if they do go forward with reconciliation for this package, what and whether they can do through that. So something like whether the $15 minimum wage is possible to do via reconciliation is very much up in the air, where you have folks like Senator Bernie Sanders, who think that $15 minimum wage is possible through reconciliation. It is something that Democrats should move forward with. But then you have other Democrats who are a little bit more wary of whether you can do a straightforward $15 minimum wage through reconciliation. And if to try and, achieve that, you would have to basically break new procedural ground by changing the rules or, voting to override some of the existing rules and basically creating a new precedent for skirting or ignoring some of the, you know, historical restrictions on the reconciliation process. So there's a lot that's up in the air right now. There are definitely a bunch, you know, several Democrats who are still kind of singing a song about how bipartisanship is the best path forward and Democrats should try and work with Republicans. Obviously, a lot of Republicans are not exactly lining up to support President Biden's relief plan. And so there are a few different calculations that Democrats are trying to make right now about the path forward.
And let me just clarify, Professor Gross, on reconciliations, you said the Senate has very few rules. This isn't written down. To undo the filibuster, obviously you'd have to take, that's a formal process and a vote. But if reconciliation was extended to as many times as the majority wanted to do it, would there be anything to stop the majority leader from doing that? Or would that have to be voted on to change that tradition?
So I think that'd be harder, because so reconciliation does come out of law passed in the 1970s, the Congressional Budget Act. And so that specifies the reconciliation process for the budget, both the revenue side and the spending side, and then the debt limit. And then there's a rule that the Senate passed in the 80s, and this is getting into what we were just discussing, called the Byrd Rule, that basically said you can't put all this extra stuff in that isn't related to the budget. But how do you determine that? That is up to the discretion of the Senate to determine if it is budget related. And, you know, I would argue that a lot of things are budget related that the Senate does. And it really is, at the end of the day, up to them. But can you convince enough? Can you convince enough senators? Do they have the stomach to go through reconciliation? I do agree that I think there's a real advantage to getting some bipartisan support. You don't have to get 60 votes to pass bills. You just need to not have you need to have 60 people not willing to stop legislation. And so I think if the Democrats are able to get a bill to the floor not through reconciliation, they're going to be in better. It's going to be better for them, both in terms of the way it appears, but also in terms of potential objections, that senators are going to be able to potentially object to putting things in like the minimum wage into reconciliation, and then they'll have to figure out if it counts as a budget. It's a budget item or not.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for walking us through these terms, what reconciliation is, what the filibuster is, and whether there's appetite to change that rule, which requires 60 Senate votes to pass legislation, unless it's subject to reconciliation, and how the Senate is organizing itself, its operational structure, given the 50-50 split between parties. Thank you both very much. I appreciate it. Joining us, Andy Duren of the Wall Street Journal, Christian Gross of USC, where he's professor of political science and public policy. He's also the academic director of the USC Schwarzenegger Institute for State and Global Policy. You're listening to Air Talk on KPECC. Coming up, the very latest on COVID-19.